Hello everyone and welcome to the first oneliner.com podcast of our Year of the Lord 2012. I am Craig Eastman and as always I'm joined by Scott Morris.
Delighted to meet you.
And Drew Tavendale.
Similarly delighted.
We've got a little bit to catch up on, so let's crack on with the show. We join you now in the midst of awards season. It's always a good time, isn't it? It's a time of worthy filmage. There's that sort of drought that leads up to now and a drought immediately afterwards, isn't there? Everything's concentrated at this time of year. And it's the best time of the year for illegally down-stealing screener copies of things. that's primarily the reason for our love for January/February. All manner of worthy fare coming our way. First on our list, I suppose, guys, we'd better talk about War Horse.
If we must.
Yes, adaptation of what's his chops?
Michael Morpurgo,
there we are. Adaptation of Michael Morpurgo's very well-regarded children's book, which has already been adapted for the stage, for theatre, to great critical acclaim. And, well, Chris Tookey from Daily Mail, his quotes about how excellent it is are all over the TV advert, so it must be good, right, Scott?
That's one way of putting it. It's the wrong way of putting it. But, yes.
Don't tell me Chris Tookey's a liar.
I'm not saying he's a liar. I'm just saying that I respect his opinion and it's wrong.
I don't respect his opinion. I'm quite surprised working for the Daily Mail he hasn't said that War Horse either causes or cures cancer.
Mm.
Unless he did, because I also haven't read his review. But it sounds like he's a stupid person.
Bloody War Horses going over to mainland Europe, taking all the other horses' jobs.
Regardless, it's been highly Oscar-buzzed, if that's a term. If it's not, I'm saying that it is, as the young farmhand Albert, played by Jeremy Irvine, takes a shine to his thoroughbred horse, which his father, Peter Mullen, ill-advisedly buys as a farmyard animal, proves eventually to be an able workhorse, although quite why Devon looks like Hobbiton is beyond me. Soon enough, the First World War appears, and the horse is sold off to the army, entering the 1st Machine Gun Fodder Division of our army.
Headed by Mr. Tom Hiddleston.
Yes, and we follow the horse as it traipses around randomly France, either by itself or attached to various armed forces, and we get to revel in the stories of his various soldiers or farmer handlers as the film goes on. It takes the form essentially of a series of vignettes, none of which really last long enough to make any real impact or connection with anyone, which is really my main issue with the film. It's technically well put together and so forth, as you'd probably expect from Steven Spielberg. I don't think you can pick too many technical faults with it, but emotionally, it's just a whistle-stop tour of 4 years of war with really very little sense of time passing and very little drama, despite all that setup. I just didn't find it particularly interesting. I just can't get myself particularly behind a horse. I'm not particularly sympathetic to horses. It's not a very anthropomorphic kind of animal, I find. And the repeated reference to it being some kind of miracle horse, when at best it was kind of lucky.
It's a lucky horse.
And isn't a miracle that they came together? Well, not really. The horse is in the middle of a war, and the soldiers at war, they're both in the same place. It's not really that coincidental.
There's large parts where the horse ends up caught in some wire in the middle of no man's land between trenches. Who is the horse there? How could it possibly have got there? It's a miracle horse. It survived. No, it just sort of ran in there in the night when nobody was shooting, and you saw it before you started shooting in the morning. Not seeing where the miracle is here.
I mean, it's perfectly acceptable. I don't regret watching it, but I'm never going to watch it again, and I'm probably never even going to think of it again. It just made very little impact on me. I'm not quite sure who this is for. I suppose horse fanciers. That's all I can think of. That's certainly far from the worst film I've seen, but I will never think of it again. It's fine, but there are better films you could be watching, especially just now.
I do regret seeing it, because I could have seen something else instead. And what you said, Scott, about it not being the most interesting of animals, a horse. I had no interest in horses myself, but even if it had been something that I really liked, like a dog or a tiger, I still don't think I would have found it in any way compelling, because there's no reason to care about anybody in it. And the story, there isn't really a story. It's, as you said, the horse is lucky and some stuff happens to it. And then you've got just things there that bother me. Like, you've got an old man travels a long way because he hears about this horse and knows it must be this special horse. But the reason the horse would be special doesn't make any sense. The reason he would know about it makes no sense.
He's a senile old man.
The film's absolutely full of plot holes. None of the characters are compelling. And everybody's going on as being a miracle horse, but there's not any one person in the film who can possibly know even 1/10 of all the stuff that happened to the horse. So from the point of view of the viewer, you might understand all the things that have happened to this horse and it's survived, but none of the humans in it can possibly know, so they can't possibly be considering this a miracle horse. And the whole film seems to be predicated on the idea that this is some kind of super horse.
My beef with it is that you just can't do anything on that type of scope in less than 3 hours.
Yeah.
The text that this comes from, the story of War Horse, is something, obviously the end result isn't in the same leagues, but the subject matter is up there in the realms of potentiality with the likes of Lawrence of Arabia and tales like that. And Lawrence of Arabia, David Lean couldn't tell Lawrence of Arabia in less than 3.5 hours at best. So, all right, okay, I didn't feel like War Horse had weighed in at like almost 2.5 hours. It felt like a 2-hour film, so I must have enjoyed it at least to some degree. But you can't cover that kind of scope and expect me to engage with characters in a story of that magnitude with a running time that long. Like you say, there's so little sense of time passing in this film that you are given no sense of scope whatsoever. It's like someone's replaced a Littlest Hobo with a horse and just spliced 4 episodes together really quickly and really shoddily. I thought it was bizarre. I'm sure I haven't experienced the novel. I haven't encountered the stage production at all, so I came to the film absolutely blind, but obviously, no pun intended, it comes with some pedigree. Expectations are high. Steven Spielberg's on board to direct. Do we reckon this might be potential classic in waiting? Ooh, it certainly looks like it might be. And I thought, it's just been given such short thrift from the start. I couldn't help but feel as well that you come to a Steven Spielberg film, there are certain things that you expect. There's little bits of Spielberg flair. And to be honest with you, I felt that after about the first 20 minutes, half an hour of the film, it almost felt as if he'd given up and just decided to tell the straight story. There was very little to engage me with. I was incredibly put off by the fact as well that at any point I was expecting Jeremy Irvine, the young lad who has the horse at the start, to call it Master Frodo at some point. Please, come on. That section of the film, that's as annoying as the accents are, and I don't mean to offend anybody in the Southwest there, that's the only part of the film that even threatens to engage, and it's probably no coincidence that that's because those are the characters that you get to spend the most time with. There's such a roster of talent attached to this film, it's unreal, and most of them have got like 5-10 minutes at best on screen. Yeah. And you can't help but feel that the only reason these guys must have turned up to take part in this film was just, oh, this is probably the only chance I'm going to get to work with Steven Spielberg.
I know, it's kind of disappointing in that respect, Craig. We've got people like Benedict Cumberbatch in it.
Benedict Cumberbatch and
three minutes he's in it, something like that, 2 lines perhaps.
Yeah, Benedict Cumberbatch, who I still haven't quite connected with as a viewer so far, and a great deal of stuff is done, but I haven't seen Sherlock on BBC yet, which everyone tells me I'm insane, I should catch up with it. But I was more concerned about, there's people like Eddie Marson in there. Eddie Marson gets 3 lines and he's there for 90 like seconds. And I know that's because Eddie Marson's gone. Oh, Jesus, yeah, oh, Steven Spielberg. But he's worked with Michael Mann. He had more time on screen in Miami Vice with Michael Mann, and probably to greater effect, even though he was given short thrift there as well. And it's just this roster of people who have turned up just to get 5 minutes of screen time in a Steven Spielberg film. And the net result is just a huge disappointment.
You know what you're saying, too, though, about it coming with a lot of pedigree? I'm not convinced it does. I know it had lots of plaudits in the theatre, but so as the film had lots of plaudits, and it's come, and you're talking about it being an epic scale, but it's based on a 192-page children's book. Mm. It can't have been that epic to begin with.
It's also
partially scripted by Richard Curtis. I don't find that a promising sign at all.
Alarm bells are ringing, Willie. Yeah, no, but the thing is, though, I suppose you expect that maybe a kid's novel's not going to have that scope, but the subject matter of it is something that demands scope. It's going to take you more than two hours, 20 minutes to read the kids' novel, I should imagine.
You're going to struggle to span all of World War One in 2 and a bit hours.
Hmm.
That seems to be the scope of it. And so, as I say, it just does come down to these little series of vignettes which have to rely on cliches because you don't really have any time to set anything up. Hmm. Hence, you've got, you know, oh, Master Frodo, we're in the farm, that kind of stuff.
And it's, oh, I need to plough the field, Master Frodo! It's that, how, oh, come on, how annoying was this exposition? Just, oh, obvious exposition, I'm going to speak out, I'm going to vocalise it towards the horse as if the viewer doesn't understand the situation my family's in. Oh, come on, horsey, we need to plough the field, otherwise the nasty man's going to come back and throw us out of our house. He's turned out, he's gone Irish at the end there. It was a terrible performance. I just thought, it was, for a Spielberg film, I just thought, oh dear, it felt, did I say it? It felt like amateur hour. It looked lovely. I'll give it that. It looked lovely.
Well, alternates between looking lovely and looking like the most unrealistic thing I've seen in a good long while.
There's a lot of shots, particularly the night shots towards the end, particularly when the kids had an injury. Mm. And everything was like, well, that looks very much like a soundstage. So it's like a television production.
I think the problem with it, it's not quite that there's two Steven Spielbergs, but there's definitely one who's kind of a proper serious filmmaker, and there's the other one who's a bit too saccharine and schmaltzy, and this is the one who's shown up for this. And it's trying too heavily to kind of crank emotional levers than it is to actually tell the story.
It's trying too hard to crank emotional levers, but here's the litmus test for me. Before we sat down to watch it, I said to my wife, and you guys know the score, I said to her, I know already what state I'm going to be in by the end of this film. It's got all the hallmarks. It's the central characters are a young boy who has an emotional bond with an animal. It's a scenario that's fraught with danger. I'm going to be a mess by the end of this, man. I'm a girl's blouse when it comes to that stuff, as you well know. You're talking to the man who was crying at How to Train Your Dragon. Right, so I sat down to this film with a king size box of Kleenex there, ready to rock and roll. I'm like, yeah, come on Spielberg, bring it, my eyes can take it. And by the end of it, not a thing. Didn't care one way or another. They could have put a bullet in that horse's head. Eddie Marson could have shot that horse in the face and urinated on it, US Marine style, and I wouldn't have cared one way or the other. And that's saying something. That's saying something for me.
For someone so in touch with his emotions and tear ducts as you, this is definitely a downside. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Likewise, made very little impact on me, and I'm not as down on it as much as Drew does. It's okay, but I could struggle to recommend anyone to actually go and see it. Maybe it's better for a younger audience, I don't know, but it's certainly not good for me.
I don't know, I keep on thinking, I'm talking about, you said, Scott, that you couldn't cover all of World War One in that sort of time frame. And you can't. But even just like war in general and the horrors of war, this is from the man that made Saving Private Ryan. He knows how to do it and do it very, very competently indeed. And there's just no real sense of the horrors of war that film needed, I feel.
The thing is, I think they've kept in mind while they're making it, though, look, the source of this ultimately is a children's novel. And it needs to be a film that a younger audience can see. So they've obviously worked to PG-13/12A constrictions. And I've heard a lot of people saying, oh, you know, for that, it's quite harsh. So some of the scenes at the end are quite intense. And I was expecting that. I thought, oh, it sounds like Private Ryan Light. And really, by the end of it, for a 12 certificate, it's still not that. With a couple of minor cuts, you could have gotten away with a PG easily enough. And I think probably its greatest folly is that it's... I think Spielberg's completely underestimated a young audience, because I think when it comes to subject matter like that, I think kids have got a far greater propensity to be able to deal with that sort of thing than we give them credit for. And I think back to the first couple of years in high school or whatever, when we were showing Schindler's List as on an educational basis. Now, that was a 15 rated film with some and a Spielberg film with some horrendous atrocities that itself was granted a 15 by the BBFC in lieu of an 18 because of the historical context and the importance of it. And it was still given out in an educational print with, I think, like two or three minor cuts to it, but for the most part in an unmolested print. And that was being bandied round as on the grounds of being an educational thing. And, you know, like a young audience, okay, maybe not as young, you're talking about like 13, 14, we're being credited with the sort of emotional maturity to be able to cope with that. So why pander on this occasion to a much lower or a much tighter constriction on that sort of thing? If you want to make a story about a horse going to war sad, then you can't make an omelette without breaking a few eggs. Maybe that's it. I'm just disappointed not enough people were shot in the face.
No more Call of Duty for that man.
I'm sure we could have had some missing limbs and still kept to a 12A. Come on. Good gracious. Warhorse, so are we calling it a disappointment? I'm not saying it's not all right, but it's disappointing, isn't it?
I'm saying it's not all right.
For something that is, you know, nominated for Golden Globes and umpteen awards, and, you know, there's people talking seriously about Oscars for it, yes, it's a disappointment.
Well, have they got an Oscar for Best Horse this year?
Yes, they always do.
Yeah, I can imagine it might win that.
Yeah.
Or this year's Oscar for largest disappointment, this year's Oscar for cloying sentimentality, the cinematography on top of a chocolate box award goes to...
Yeah, I mean, Spielberg does have a great propensity for that. It seems to be something of a weakness for him. But very often it might be something just sort of sours, ironically, because it's so much sweetness, but sours the end of an otherwise good film. But in this case, he just sort of started off with like the chocolate box lid pictures you're seeing, Craig. and doesn't really let up.
I'm saying it's a good-looking film, and lo and behold, I mean, it is a good-looking film. But I was disappointed. I hadn't done my research beforehand, but I was assuming about half an hour in, I turned to my wife and I said, please tell me this isn't Janusz Kaminski. I should have known, because I think, has he been Spielberg's DP on everything since Private Ryan? Just about everything, I think, yeah. And I thought, please tell me this isn't Janusz Kaminski, the man who took us up the beaches of Normandy in such a frenetic and kinetic fashion, and lo and behold, it was. Never mind, Janusz. There's always the next film. Okay, so another film with the weight of expectation on its shoulders, which is currently doing the rounds in your local multiplex, is The Artist, lauded for its silent sensibility. Guys, I haven't had the chance to catch up with The Artist yet, but Drew, perhaps you could fill us in.
Well, The Artist is about a silent film star. It's set in the heyday of that, early to mid-1920s in Hollywood, and it's really just a story of his personal life and professional life as they're affected by films becoming talkies instead. And the premise of it is quite simple, story-wise. But the real twist here, if you can call it a twist, is that the film is A, in 4:3, B, in black and white, and C, almost entirely silent, other than for the orchestral score. There. That sums it up.
Awesome. No, I'm just flicking through the pictures on IMDb here, and I'm wondering why there's a picture of a man who appears to be Michael Parkinson.
Right. Michael Parkinson.
Is it Parky? No, it's Costa Gavras, who looks stunningly like Michael Parkinson.
Hold on, let me have a look at this picture. So I don't have much more to say about that, because the premise of the film is fairly simple.
Scott, perhaps you'd like to elucidate.
To be honest, no, not really. It is a perfectly charming film. Right, again, this is another one of the major Oscar contenders. Everyone seems to love The Artist. It's very high concept. Now, I'll say this up front, because it is a perfectly charming film, and it's a good film, and I enjoyed it. However, what annoys me more about this is the way that it's been spoken of as a great film, and I really don't think it is.
No, it isn't.
It's one of these films that is so heavily predated on the technique and the artifice of the silent film that it's using that as a smokescreen to hide the fact that there's really very little story behind it, and it's deliberately hampering itself. The performances are simply hampered by the medium. About a decade ago, there's a film called Far From Heaven, which is really the same kind of thing. It's just this academic exercise in tying your own hands behind your back. And I don't really see what purpose it serves other than just gimmickry. As we've done previously many times over, I get very ranty when a film is put into 3D for no good reason. I get very ranty when films use non-linear narratives for no good reason. And this seems to just be using, you know, silence and black and white and its unusual aspect ratio and so forth as another technique for no good reason. I think you could tell the same film better. You could do the same story far better, and we'd be able to know more about what the George Valentin, the nominal star of the film, played by Jean Dujardin, the silent film actor who refuses to go into the talkies. We'd know more about this character if he talked, rather than just have to sort of gurn at the screen. So why are you hampering yourself with this? I want to get very upset about that, but to be honest, I can't, because it does it so well that it just gets away with it. Like Hugo, which I think we'll talk about later, it's just this love letter to a bygone age. And if you've any love at all for film, and I suppose if you're listening to a film review podcast, you probably do, then it is essential viewing, and it's definitely worth looking at. I can't get behind it being a brilliant film, but I can get behind it as being a very enjoyable film. I don't think it's everything that it's hyped up to be, but it is highly enjoyable. You've got these great performances from, Jean Dujardin in the first part. He's doing as well as anyone could possibly do without speaking. The story itself is paper thin, but it is still quite interesting. There's not an awful lot to it, but that kind of membrane, that crossover between the talkies and the silent films and the kind of changing of the guard, it's interesting. It's perhaps not enough to really kind of base a whole film on without having it fleshed out a bit.
Would you describe it as charming?
You really can't describe it as anything other than charming.
I just find it, like I say, for the reasons that you stated, I mean, I've nothing to base my opinions on because I haven't seen the film. But for me, something of such slight artifice, like I say, for which the whole notion of the silent cinema is essentially a smokescreen for a very, you know, thin plot and quite a slender tale. An hour and 40 minutes? Does it sustain that reasonably well? Because to me, that's sort of a concept. I'm thinking to myself, okay, that's 80, 90 minutes at a push.
There is a moment towards the middle of a film where, and it's pretty much it's the first of two uses of sound, which a lot of people are saying is it's a masterstroke, which got me very irritated at that point. And it was for about 10 minutes after that, I was really kind of just going, I'm ready to be contrarian on this and sort of sitting in a huff, but it does win you back over. It is infused with charm to get away with it. I know where you're coming from, because I felt almost the same thing when I sat down, because I'm like that. I'm just a contrarian, gruff annoyance. It won me over. It does very well. I won't be talking about this as the film of the year next year or anything like that. It probably won't get a mention, but it's enjoyable, and I certainly don't regret watching it. It's a much more enjoyable watch than War Horse was.
Indeed.
I know exactly where you're coming from, because I theoretically have exactly the same concerns as you do with the artifice of it all. But at the end of the day, it just kind of wins you over by being so good. It's like maybe it was at 2012, the...
2046.
Yeah, that was 20-something.
2046, yes.
That would be open to the same kind of thing. It is, you know, it's all... It's style over substance for the most part, but it gets away with it. Exactly. And this is the same kind of thing. It just gets away with it. And yeah, enjoyed it very much.
Fair play.
Yeah, I can't really disagree with anything Scott said at all, other than almost exactly the same thoughts and reservation, just enjoyed it more, I think. I found it absolutely delightful. A very entertaining film is. The characters are very engaging, lightweight as the story is, and there's a good bit of humour in it. It's really quite a fun film, but it's certainly not a great film. And artifice is exactly the word. Or gimmick is probably better. The idea of it being in black and white and silent, etc., is a gimmick. It's an entertaining film, very much. You've just got to think, though, that perhaps the reason so many people are like calling it a great film and want to give it awards is just that so much that comes out of Hollywood looks exactly the same as all the other stuff that comes out of Hollywood. The fact that somebody's done anything different, artificial as it may be, is like, oh, wow, this has taken me by surprise. It's not the same as all those other films I saw all year.
Yeah.
And it's not a sequel, and it's not a comic book film.
I would imagine there's definitely an element of that. And I suppose I can only applaud that, which I will do for any film that tries to be different, even if it does wind up not being very good. This one is different and good, which is a rare confluence and one to be applauded.
To be fair, we're getting to the point where a film being released in good old 2D is going to be enough to make it stand out. I don't know. I haven't looked at the technical specs for it, but was it shot in black and white film stock, or has it been shot digitally and just obviously?
I think it's been shot digitally. It looks too crisp to have been... Well, I mean, that's a stupid thing to say, I guess.
That is a stupid thing to say.
It feels... I don't know, there's something about it feels like it's shot.
Say 10 Hail Marys.
It says film negative of 35mm, Kodak Vision 3, 500T5219. You know much more about film than I do. You could probably tell off the top of your head if that's black and white or colour.
I don't know the film ones. I've done some research into some of them for certain films that I really like the look of, but I don't know about that particular.
Well, the fact that it says, well, Cinemagraphic Process is a Super 35 source format and Digital Intermediate is a master format, so yes. There's certainly been digital hands going through this, if nothing else.
I was going to say, I assume it's probably been shot on colour film and converted later.
Yeah.
But, oh, at least a shot on film. That would be the kicker for me. If they'd had the gall to take a silent film, black and white, and actually shoot it on digital, I would have...
This being shot on a Canon 5D Mark II or something.
Yeah, exactly.
DSLR.
Kodak Vision 3 500T is indeed colour negative film.
Yeah, colour negative.
I'd imagine you must struggle to get black and white film. I mean, in terms of film stock.
Yeah, I was going to say, for roll film, for film stock, yeah, certainly. I would imagine that's... I don't know if anyone produces it anymore. It's probably just going to be far too expensive because of the silver content. Mm-hmm. So it's turning into a photography podcast. I should imagine the silver content would probably render it prohibitively expensive these days unless you were shooting on tabular film that doesn't really use silver. But in which case, you might as well just shoot on digital. Because T-Max is for bitches.
Kodak do still sell black and white negative film.
For filming purposes?
For filming purposes, yep.
Good lord.
Or as well as Kodak are doing anything, given it's just filed for bankruptcy protection.
Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection. Exactly. Eastman XX black and white negative film.
Eastman?
XX. I know I'm to blame. Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol. Okay, Tom Cruise, who's now how old? 50?
74.
He's 74. 49, he's pushing... he'll be... Jesus, yeah, he'll be 50 this year. Tom. Still acting like he's in his mid-20s to early 30s. Scott, Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol. Where does it stand in the pantheon of Mission Impossible movies?
To be fair, Tom's very well preserved. He must have, like, the ring or something.
He's got some sort of painting in his attic that's showing all these
There's, I'm just saying, there's something funny about Tom Cruise. I'm not sure what it is.
Is it not just that he's being replaced by aliens from the planet Thraxos or something every couple of years?
We're not allowed to talk about that, otherwise there'll be Scientologists following us around everywhere.
Yeah.
Regardless, Mission Impossible 4, Ghost Protocol, actually one of the better Mission Impossibles. To be fair, this is not giving it a lot of praise because I can't remember a damn thing about any of the other Mission Impossible films. Their watchword has always been disposability. However, this does feel like something of a reboot of the franchise. Incredibles director Brad Bird takes the helm in what I think was his first live-action movie, or certainly in recent times. It does recycle a few of the themes from earlier films, but in this one you've got the Impossible Mission Force taking wind of a plan being hatched by a Russian madman to start a nuclear war, which would be a bad thing. Although the first film, first mission to stop him starts a little bit too late, Tom Cruise and his merry band are left carrying the can when said Nutter, codenamed Cobalt, steals a launch computer from the Kremlin and then blows the Kremlin up.
Damn.
With the entire IMF taking the blame for this, it's shut down and it's left for Hunt and his band of agents to catch Cobalt and save the world with only the barest minimum of supporting gadgets from the IMF, the one safe house they could get to.
As many gadgets as they could stick in an overnight bag.
Yes, well, funnily enough, despite this being the dregs of what is available to them, it turns out to be exactly the right mix of gadgets needed to fulfil some very silly missions, but...
How convenient.
How very convenient.
Ha! You've put the suction cups in the bag, Tom. What do you think, we're going to be climbing a skyscraper or something?
His theme this time round is, of course, well, Tom Cruise, Ethan Hunt, your main octogenarian leader. You have Token Comic Relief, played by Simon Pegg, returning from Mission Impossible 3, if memory serves, and Token Woman, Paula Patton, who may as well not exist, and a marginally more fleshed-out role for Jeremy Renner, who makes a very welcome addition to the squad. Now, it's not a damned thing more than a glossy action flick, popcorn fodder, that sort of thing, and it's still very much the Tom Cruise show. So if you're not in the mood for some disposable entertainment, or you can't stand Tom Cruise, this is not going to be your cup of tea at all. That said, it's very well executed, it's very slickly handled, and it's admirably pacey. It's basically fulfilling its brief very well. For my money, definitely the best of the franchise, although, admittedly, none of the others are particularly memorable. It is, as you'd expect, essentially just a series of big, glossy stunts, but it does film those stunts very well. There's a few of the kind of more spy capers going on there, but it's very small. Most of it is basically around these big set-piece stunts, but it never stops, it never really lets up enough to kind of get you bored at any one point. It just keeps going. Tom Cruise is the same character you're used to from every other Tom Cruise film. He's perfectly acceptable. Jeremy Renner's a bit of a revelation. He's one of my favourite actors who've kind of come to prominence over the past few years, so it's good seeing him in this. He does a marginally more complex character than you'd expect from this kind of... It's a fairly obvious sort of hidden past story, but it does give it a bit of depth to something which is certainly not a franchise known for its emotional complexity. So any of that does help, and he's quite good in the role. It's quite good. I quite enjoyed it. I think it may be the first film I've watched in IMAX, certainly for years, and it makes very good use of that. It does look jaw-droppingly good in places. Surprising as it may be, I actually recommend it quite a lot. If you're in the mood for just an action film, this is a very good choice.
You know the last film I saw in IMAX? Superman Returns.
Bad choice.
It's been a long time. I saw Scott Pilgrim in an IMAX screen, but not projected, obviously, as IMAX, because that wasn't shot in IMAX. Boo. Did you say poor choice?
I was not impressed by Superman Returns.
Superman Returns was okay.
Okay, yes, but...
It was basically the first Superman again. For intents and purposes.
I remember it was my proudest moment of, alright, okay, so we do this podcast and nobody in the world's heard of us. Many subscribers do we have, Scott? Did we reckon at the last count?
I don't recall.
Got a few thousand?
Yeah.
A few thousand, that's pretty cool. Okay, but we're not exactly well known. But on the rare occasion of Googling my name and not finding the Canadian violinist, I remember my proudest moment being someone mentioning my review of Superman Returns, in which I berated people for saying this is a film. Nothing happens in this film, by pointing out that it's a film in which a man lifts an entire continent. That's a little trip down memory lane for you there. Mission Impossible, Ghost Protocol, check it out, if you must. Another film then from a cinematic master, Hugo, is a film many, many people have been waiting on for a number of reasons, not only because it was Martin Scorsese's latest film, and Martin Scorsese is obviously quite frequently value for money, but also the 3D naysayers have been incredibly interested in this one, because Martin Scorsese seemed to be particularly excited about making a film in 3D, and Hugo is it, Drew.
Yes.
Has Martin Scorsese overreached himself here?
Well, I don't know, because I saw it in 2D. So, which actually...
You've maybe trapped this.
This is possibly the first time ever I'm rather disappointed. I couldn't see in 3D, but by the time I got around to seeing it, all the 3D screenings had gone.
Well, hang on, before we go on, Scott, did you see it in 3D?
No.
Oh, bollocks, right, okay. So let's... It's a gimmick anyway, so let's... Drew, carry on. Let's treat it purely on merits as a piece of storytelling.
What? Heresy!
A bit about the story first then. Hugo, based on a story called The Invention of Hugo Cabret, is about a young boy, 12 years old I think, who he lives in the walls of a train station, and all the machinery that runs all the station's clocks behind there. He's ended up there after his father died in a fire, and he's claimed by his uncle, who takes him to the train station, shows him how to work the clocks, and promptly buggers off. So he's this 12-year-old boy left on his own, trying to keep out of the sights of Sacha Baron Cohen's station inspector, and trying to put back together a little metal automaton that his father and he had been working on before his father's death. That's the setup for it. The story goes on to talk about the adventures this kid has, meeting this sort of cranky, perhaps, old man who runs a clockwork toy shop, his goddaughter trying to keep out of the way of the station inspector, who's something along the lines of the child catcher from Chitty Chitty Bang Bang's, the way he's set up. And, I had to finish that sentence, so I'll go.
With a full stop?
That'll do.
Yay!
It is like the artist sort of a peer into a lost stage of cinema, amongst other things, and artifice in terms of people making things rather than the film having artifice. So it starts off not particularly promisingly, actually. The little boy, Hugo, seems to be nothing more than a little thief, as we're introduced to him, and has this facial expression for most of the first 30 minutes that makes you want to smack him in the face with a train.
If you happen to have one handy.
Yes.
Says the Incredible Hulk over there.
Also, the nature of his constant flight from the station inspector has all the makings of being a farce, which doesn't seem promising, but fortunately it doesn't turn into that. It turns into a rather touching story of a boy without parents finding his first real friend and finding he has an unexpected connection with the man running the toy shop.
It is Scorsese's love letter to early days of cinema, just like we just spoke about with the artist. I think the critical difference is that when you watch this in 2D, as we did, it's still a really nice film. I still really enjoyed this. I think if you stripped all the gimmickry away from the artist, it would be kind of boring. Hugo has a very strong central story, which I really enjoyed. I think perhaps, I've not seen it in 3D, but I'm assuming it's going to have the same kind of arguments as Coraline. The 3D kind of helps add texture and things, but it just works because it's a really good story, rather than it works specifically because it's in 3D. I loved it. Same kind of complaints as Drew, I think. First half hour, Hugo's not very likeable, which is a problem. I think also you could have taken out Sacha Baron Cohen's character completely and made it a far better film. It doesn't really serve any purpose. I don't understand what it's there for other than to give it a few chase scenes.
No, he's a bit clownish, really, isn't he?
Yeah. He serves no narrative function. I don't really know what he's there for.
I think that the only thing really that he might serve to do is for him to be one more person for Hugo to help, in a way, I guess. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it could easily have done without him.
That aside, highly enjoyable and very touching. I'm not sure if Craig's tear ducts would survive the Ben Kingsley speech at the end. I was teetering on the edge myself there. It is just very touching. Ben Kingsley, for all his many flaws as a person, from what I understand, he can act quite well. He's quite good at the old acting when he's not playing an obvious evil character. This is relatively complex, especially for a kind of kids' film, emotionally at least, and it plays very well. There's lots of nice touches in terms of a lot of the performances. It looks stunning, even in 2D. This whole pre-war Paris looks absolutely beautiful, handled very well cinematographically. Strange, I don't know if I've seen Martin Scorsese do a kids' film before, so I don't know what basis of a comparison
I've got. I certainly can think of one. I know he's done a film with like a kid being on the central bits in Kundun. And he said he's tried his hand at a great many different types of films, but I can't remember him doing a kid's film before.
Kundun, although it was like a PG certificate, I think it wasn't necessarily like a pictures of a family film. It's his first family film.
No, it was just saying it was featured a kid as the central character.
It's certainly his first family film.
And I loved
it. He suggested The Departed wasn't.
Yeah.
Well, it was a family film in a different kind of sense, I think.
I remember when I was three and my dad first made me watch Mean Streets.
I loved Hugo. I don't know if it would be better or worse than if it was in 3D, but I thought it was a really lovely film. Charming, yeah.
Yeah, it's absolutely delightful. And after the first half hour, because it gives you the idea that it's going to be a different film from what it actually is. And as I say, it's worrying that the kid seems so unlikable at first, but you really get to warm to him, particularly when you find out his story.
Yeah.
And he begins to interact with Ben Kingsley in particular.
Mm-hmm.
And he's got very good chemistry with Chloe Moretz as well as the goddaughter. The only thing sort of technically that bothered me, I did want to see this in 3D, which is a real first, because from people whose opinions I respect and other things, seemed like Martin Scorsese may have been one of the only people that actually got it. The other two things are the colours are really, really saturated in 2D, and I wonder if that is because, as we discussed, Scott, that because of the 40% loss of saturation you get with 3D, whether the 2D print has been amped and left, not sort of corrected for that.
But surely the 2D print would be produced independently anyway, so I can't imagine that's the reason.
I don't know, it depends how competently it's done.
I can't imagine that's the reason. It's an interesting thought, though.
That's all, because it was so very, very oversaturated colour-wise. Although, I mean, the look of the station is particularly, and the bits of Paris you do see are very clearly not real, but it's very clearly a stylistic choice, so it may be part of that. The only other thing is that some of the scenes, particularly early on, I didn't notice as much later, whether I just sort of accepted by then, I don't know, but some of the early scenes are very, very clearly set up to be 3D things with a big pendulum swinging towards the screen. That's a minor point, that's just a minor technical issue. It's a delightful film, and I would highly recommend anybody saw it.
See it now. Still, it's actually still, I think, still weekend showings and things at a lot of cinemas, so got a chance to catch up if you need to.
Yeah, certainly some of the bigger cine worlds, I think, have got a good chance of seeing it still.
Sherlock Holmes, A Game of Shadows. Guy Ritchie's sequel to his, was it 2008 now? The first Sherlock Holmes film?
Possibly, either that year before, I think. It's been a few years.
It's been a couple of years, isn't it, Sherlock Holmes?
No, 2009 apparently. 2009, it feels like much longer than 2 years.
2009.
It feels like so much longer.
Guy Ritchie, that most English of directors, is back with a sequel to a film which was all right.
that sums up the first one pretty well.
Yeah.
The first one was all right. It was reasonably funny, reasonably entertaining, but it was nothing special.
Scott, is Sherlock Holmes, A Game of Shadows, all right?
It's surprisingly much better than all right. Which
what?
Is
indeed
very rare to say that kind of thing about a sequel, especially in this kind of thing.
Mm.
Robert Downey Jr.'s back, Jude Law's back, Guy Ritchie's back directing, but this time they have to uncover the fiendish machinations of Jared Harris's Moriarty, the standard arch nemesis of Holmes.
Ooh.
He's in the midst of pulling strings that would start a world war, so ooh, high stakes indeed. Now, this is Sherlock Holmes in the same way that D'Artagnan and the Three Muskerhounds is Dumas's Three Musketeers. The plot, the characterisation, Holmes' detective methods, they're all cranked up to these ludicrous extremes. It's definitely not a film for purists, as with the first one. It is, however, a hell of a lot of fun, so I can let that slide. Downey Jr., as increasingly is the norm for him, is an absolute joy to watch.
Yeah, and he's clearly having a hoot too, isn't he? Which
absolutely
really comes through.
Yeah, you can tell when he's having fun. It elevates things that are basically just schlock, things like that, the first Iron Man film. Yeah, it's all predicated on him having fun, and that really does get across. That guy's so much better when he's off the crack. Also, it's another rare appearance of the likeable version of Jude Law, who's normally known for being
indeed
prickly and slightly obnoxious.
Jude Law who you might want to have a pint with.
Yeah, he's actually very charismatic in this. It's a tremendous double act. I can't think of too many double acts I've seen in recent films that are more enjoyable than Sherlock Holmes and John Watson in this. It's just really a lot of fun to watch. Jared Harris makes an effective and quite creepy villain. I've liked him a lot since he showed up on Fringe a few years back as the bad guy from that, and he makes a very creepy looking bad guy, and it works fantastically well in this film. The plot is nonsense. Don't want to think about that for a second.
That's charitable, Scott.
That is very charitable. It does, however, just batter along so quickly and so entertainingly that you don't really think about it. And it's tried to say that that's a strength of the film, that it's a weak plot that you can effectively ignore, but that's kind of what it comes across as. Just never dwell on it and just kind of concentrate on having fun with it. The only quibble I've got is with a slight bit of stylistic choices where there's a escape sequence where the escape sequence appears to have escaped from the Matrix franchise.
Yeah, exactly. It's taking place in the Matrix, yes.
I wouldn't mind it so much, but it's a motif that's never returned to and is never explained. It's just, you know, a strange stylistic choice in, you know, two-thirds through the film for
it's
no particular
like
reason.
You imagine he watched the Matrix 12, 13 years ago and thought, I really like that. This is the first chance he's actually had to do it.
Yeah.
It's been on his to-do list for all that time.
That, however, is, I think, a fairly small matter. All of the rest of it is actually really, really nice. It's the most kind of fun knockabout film since Richie's, well, certainly in Richie's canon since, you know, probably Snatch. There's lots of really nice characters in there. Particular plaudits to Mycroft Holmes, played by Stephen Fry. There's lots of little nice moments throughout the film. It's very entertaining all the way throughout. I found it frequently very funny, and also it's what is effectively an action drama. It pulls you into it and drags you along very well. I can't really think of too many complaints with the film. In terms of just sheer enjoyment, it's about as much fun as I had in the cinema in all of last year. It's certainly one of the few films that I've watched twice in one year and enjoyed as much the second time round as I had the first time. Lots of really nice bits in it. I heartily recommend it. If you weren't convinced by the first one, this is one of the rare cases where I'd say, actually, go and give this one a second chance. It's I quite like the first one, probably a bit more than you did, but yeah, it's still basically okay. This is a far better take on the franchise, and as you kind of alluded to earlier, I think it's far better than a television Sherlock Holmes, which frankly suck. This I loved, so yeah, I'd certainly recommend giving it a bash.
Yeah, I certainly would too.
I will certainly catch up with it at some point, because Kelly Riley's in it again.
Mm.
Fond of her, aren't you?
Kelly Riley.
She's not in it much, though.
No,
that's all right.
Yeah, it is one of those rare things, as you probably know, but one of those rarest of things that it's a sequel that's better than the first film, considerably too. And I don't really have anything more to add to what Scott said. It's an absolute hoot. It's really enjoyable, and there are only two things I think I would have changed about the entire film. One is I would have gotten rid of that strange Matrix-y scene we referred to, and I'd have added more Stephen Fry. Because basically you couldn't go wrong with some more Stephen Fry. Because he's playing Mycroft Holmes in a Sherlock's rather effect brother, but really he's playing Stephen Fry. And there's one scene in particular, you can just imagine that Guy Ritchie's gone, hello Stephen, can you be gay and naked and kind of Stephen Fry-ish? Certainly old chap, I can do that. And curiously enough, he does it particularly well. But he is just Stephen Fry in it, basically, which is great.
Would you say this has the great butler scenes over time, or the greatest butler scenes over time?
Maybe that's the one. There would be a third thing, perhaps, and our change would actually be if you're going to have more of Mycroft, you have more of his butler as well. I'd forgotten about that, actually. Yes, possibly the greatest butler scenes of our time.
Craig in particular would like this, because it's a film where it features someone painting themselves the same colour as the background as a camouflage attempt.
They've stolen my gag.
Yes.
Albeit I envisioned it on a grander scale.
Yes, being a road bridge.
Yes. It's nice to know my ideas are filtering down to Hollywood eventually. I'll only be appreciated after I'm dead and gone. Oh well, I shall definitely make efforts to catch up with Sherlock at some point. What can I say? That's it for our crop of the first films of 2012 / late 2011. Do we have a particular favourite? Hugo, I would assume.
Of that lot, it's tough to say. Depending on your mood, either Hugo or Sherlock Holmes, or even The Artist, which I did like quite a lot as well.
If you had to pick one, yeah, it's supposed to depend on your mood, but why see one when you can see three?
Exactly. If you had to pick one, though, Human Centipede 2?
Absolutely.
Excellent. With that, listeners, we bid you a fond adieu. We will be back after, hopefully, less of a hiatus this time, a couple of weeks' time, maybe, with some more hot off the eyeballs movie reviews. Until then, I have, as always, been Craig. With me, Scott Morris.
Goodbye.
And Drew Tavendale.
Goodbye.
Fare thee well.
Oh man, your bed's humming, by the way.
Totally.